is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
Hi, this is Coach Steve Moore, and you're listening to the Hoopheads Podcast.
Hey, Hoopheads. Wanted to take a minute to shout out our partners and friends at Dr. Dish Basketball. Their Dr. Dish shooting machines are undoubtedly the most advanced and user-friendly machines on the market, and they truly accelerate skill development faster than ever. Learn more at drdishbasketball.com and follow their incredible content at Dr. Dish B-Ball on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Mention the Hoopheads podcast and save an extra $300 on the Dr. Dish Rebel, All-Star, and CT models. Also, make sure to check out the new Dr. Dish Home Machine, which is perfect for these crazy times when gyms and schools are closed. Visit drdishbasketball.com for details. That's a great deal, Hoopheads. Get your Dr. Dish shooting machine today.
We have two at Duquesne, so it's me and another guy. We're doing everything. Do the jobs that no one else wants to do, but the things that have to be done, they have to be done well, and they have to be done efficiently.
Ari Stern is a former four-year player at the College of Worcester. He is currently a graduate assistant at Duquesne University after serving as a player development intern for the Dallas Mavericks during the 2018-2019 season. While with the Mavs, Stern collaborated with coaches in helping facilitate practices, individual workouts, and game day activities. He also contributed to Dallas's analytics efforts by assisting with film breakdown. The Phoenix, Arizona native has also worked extensively at a number of national and international basketball academies, clinics, and camps. A team captain at Worcester, Stern was part of teams that compiled a 90-30 record and made four NCAA Division III championship appearances under head coach Steve Moore, who currently ranks second on the Division III career wins list. A graduate of Sunny Slope High School, Stern was one of 10 players named to the statewide all-academic boys basketball team in Divisions I and II as a senior. Stern helped the Vikings to the state semifinals twice as they went a combined 57-8 during his junior and senior years. Stern graduated with a degree in psychology from Worcester in 2018. As part of his degree requirement, he studied the effects of mindset on athletic performance and persistence for his senior independent study thesis. He was also a member of the Phi Beta Kappa Honor Society and the NABC Honors Court. Don't miss our Hoopheads Pod webinar series with some of the top minds in the game across all levels, from grassroots to the NBA. If you're focused on improving your coaching and your team, we've got you covered. Visit hoopheadspod.com/webinars to get registered. Make sure you check out our new Hoopheads Pod network of shows, including Thrive with Trevor Huffman, Beyond the Ball, the CoachMaze.com podcast, and debuting this week, Cavaliers Central with Justin Matcham, our first podcast dedicated to covering the ins and outs of an NBA team. We are unbelievably excited for the content we're going to be bringing you in the weeks ahead as more of our new shows come to life. If you've ever thought of hosting your own basketball-themed podcast, or a pod that covers an NBA or NCAA team, we want to hear from you about joining our great lineup of show hosts. Listen in as we take a deep dive into the story of breaking into the coaching profession with Ari Stern from Duquesne University in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hello and welcome to the Hoopheads Podcast. It's Mike Klinzing here with my co-host Jason Sunkel, and tonight we are pleased to welcome to the podcast from Duquesne University, Ari Stern. Ari, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
We are excited to have you on and be able to talk about some of the interesting things that you've been able to do in your relatively young basketball career. So let's start by going back in time to when you were a young kid and tell us a little bit about how you fell in love with the game of basketball, your first introduction to it.
So I kind of just inherited the game. My dad played, he's from Israel, so he played his whole life there, and they have, you know, their club system. So he worked his way up with Maccabi Tel Aviv, which is, you know, one of the best European clubs. So it was kind of just ingrained in my childhood. My mom worked for the Clippers for a couple of years, and we were just kind of a basketball family. So I really just picked it up from, I mean, my first memories are with the basketball in my hands, and it's just taken off from there, really.
What was it about the game, other than obviously your dad's direct connection to it, once you started picking it up and playing yourself, what was it about the game that you really liked?
I think for me, I started just really dribbling the ball. I was kind of one of those kids, like third grade, I'm in my driveway doing two ball dribbling, looking up every video. I was obsessed with Pistol Pete Maravich, read his book, watched the old videos. So you know, that really just having the ball in my hands and kind of just the trickery that you could do. And I would, you know, I was spinning the ball on my finger till my fingernails bled. That was just kind of the kid I was. And for me also, really one of the biggest things was growing up in Phoenix. I just was lucky enough. Nash came back to Phoenix, and I mean, he was, you know, the total dream for me. I look at him, he was, you know, a 6'1", you know, white point guard on, you know, not extremely athletic, but obviously just an incredible career. And I got to watch him, you know, on TV, but I got to go and watch him live sometimes. And he was a dream. I had long hair. I did his free throw routine. I tried to mimic his shot. I watched I was completely obsessed. I'm home now in Phoenix, and I'm looking around my room, and I have every old picture I have. It's, you know, I'm wearing a Nash jersey. I have just everything Steve Nash. He was it for me. That kind of just inspired me.
There's a lot worse guys you could probably try to emulate as a 6'1" white guy, I would say.
That, and he, and I see it more now. I guess I didn't pay attention to it as much back then, but he is like the ultimate humanitarian, great human. I don't know him personally, obviously, but just everything I see, he's just a great person. And that's kind of just tops it all off, because unbelievable player, unbelievably efficient scorer, one of the better visions in the league ever. I just think, you know, just really, he's incredible. And to be physically limited, now people don't think he's like, he was strong. He had a strong core. He had change of pace. He could change his speeds. So it wasn't like he was a slouch of an athlete, but he wasn't, you know, wasn't dunking on anyone. So maybe vertically he wasn't. So
he wasn't the traditional athlete of what we think of as a runner, jumper, dunker, that type of athlete. Rather, he was a guy who relied on great balance and, as you said, change of pace and strength and things, eye hand coordination, vision, things that are all
Mike, this sounds like you.
Unfortunately, I didn't get quite to the level that Steve Nash was able to get to.
But you didn't rely on dunking or anything, Mike.
I did not rely on dunking, that's for sure. I was not. If I had relied on dunking, my career would have ended before it got started. Let's put it that way. So we definitely don't want to talk about, we're not going to spend much of the podcast talking about my athleticism, because it'll be a very, very short podcast. We won't bore Ari with all those details. Yeah, that's nice to be able to grow up in Phoenix, to be able to watch Steve Nash day in and day out, see most of his games that are on local regional television, and be able to get a chance to go and watch him play. And obviously that team, you think back to the 7 seconds or less Phoenix Suns, and I know that I've listened to interviews with Nash and Mike D'Antoni and some of the guys that played in that era, and you hear them say all the time that they wish they had played even faster and they wish they had taken more threes. And at the time, what they were doing seemed revolutionary. And yet, if you look at today's game, they would have been near the bottom of the league in terms of pace and number of threes that they shot. And yet for their time, they were considered to be revolutionary. It's kind of amazing when you look at how the game has evolved over the last few years.
Yeah, and they completely set the standard for that. And I mean, now you look at D'Antoni and the Rockets, and I haven't looked at the numbers, but I have seen, you compare the Suns back then. I mean, they're at the bottom of the league, and it's hard to believe, because that was, I mean, it was so everything was so between, you know, in the paint, and mid range was just totally accepted and promoted. And now it's like, you know, three year key, we're taking X amount of threes a game, we're shooting within the first, you know, 7 seconds or whatever it is of the shot clock, and that's just the norm. Mostly in the NBA, not necessarily in college, but even then the trend, I mean, it trickles down the trend. I've noticed more and more that, you know, analytics becomes involved even at the college, and I'm sure even the high school levels, and they kind of design their offenses around that.
Did you ever feel that transition or see that transition as a player, either in high school or in college, where you started to see those effects of where the NBA game has gone? Did you start to see those things trickle in, or not really very much?
I think my situation was kind of unique, where I played for a high school that was almost designed around Virginia. So like long possessions and strictly, I mean, we're just gap defense and just completely defensive oriented. So we didn't see that at all in high school, just more of like an old school philosophy. And then going to Worcester and playing at Worcester for Coach Moore again, He's not at all analytic oriented, and I don't think he watches the NBA much. We never, you know, surprisingly, just, I mean, we never had any goals for the amount of threes we were taking or the pace that we were playing at. It just really wasn't a major priority. But not to say, you know, for him, it's worked. It, you know, he won 800 plus games,
right, absolutely,
playing that way. So I can't say it didn't work.
Yeah, when you finish second all time in Division III wins, I'd say that you probably could look back on your career and say that you probably did some things right over the course of that time, I would say for sure.
Yeah, he had something going right. I don't know, 800 games. That's a lot to even imagine.
That's a lot. Well, I'll tell you what. He was, his first year that he got the job was, I believe, my senior year of high school, and so he was, and I talked to him about this when we did our podcast together, but he was probably the Division III coach that for me, and I really can't put my finger on why, but he was the most memorable of the Division III coaches that recruited me. I just have a stronger memory of him being at a bunch of my games. I have a strong memory of coming out after the, you know, out in the locker room after games and having conversations with him and really liking him as a coach. And obviously I had those experiences with him at the very beginning of his career at the College of Worcester, and then you got to experience him and his coaching and the type of person that he was at the towards the tail end of his career. And it's amazing that I'm 50. How old are you right now, Ari?
I just turned 24.
All right, so we've got a 26-year age difference, and yet we both had interactions with the same head coach.
That's crazy.
Still working for the same college. It's kind of an amazing – that's an amazing journey, and obviously a credit to Coach Moore and all the success that he's been able to have. I want to think about your athletic career as a kid. Did you play any other sports when you were younger, or did you just focus on basketball right from the beginning?
I played baseball probably up until fourth grade, and then it just became full-time basketball. It became club basketball. It became summer camps. It became before school practice. I mean, it was all basketball. You know, on TV, it was basketball. When I was reading, it was basketball. I mean, there was nothing else for me. I was completely obsessed. Just a junkie. Still am today.
At what point did you start to think about wanting to play basketball beyond high school and maybe get the opportunity to play in college? When did that start to come on your radar? Was it on there early and you didn't know whether or not it was realistic? Was it something that you weren't really thinking about because you were just loving the game? Talk to me a little bit about when you started thinking about playing beyond high school.
I don't think really until my sophomore year. I didn't really understand at that time the concept of scholarships and even, you know, just the different levels, Division III. I just didn't really, I saw whatever I saw on TV. And in Arizona, I think it's unique because at that time we only had four Division Ones. GCU, Grand Canyon, had just transitioned into Division One. We had ASU, Arizona, and then Northern Arizona. And then there's, you know, there's some junior colleges, no Division Threes. You know, a few now. There's a couple more NAIAs and D2s, but at that time I didn't really have exposure to it, so I didn't really consider it. I was just kind of caught up in just playing the game and trying to get better. I think what kind of changed that for me is going into my junior year, one of my teammates, who's my best friend, Michael Humphrey, he kind of, his stock exploded. He's a big guy, 6'10", played at Stanford. And I just kind of, I saw his recruiting blowing up, and I just, you know, I started to understand the process, and he had coaches coming out. And that's one of those things I started getting interested in. Obviously, I was not that caliber player, but I had a lot of belief in myself and thought, you know, as I researched it more and realized that my academics could also help, you know, get me to an opportunity to play in college, I kind of just dove straight into it. And I really became obsessed with the Division III route. I didn't, you know, at that time, I just wasn't a Division I player. And I wasn't delusional about it. I understood my limitations. I understood, you know, where I was in the landscape of basketball. That's after playing AAU and playing in high school, I knew where I stood. So I just kind of dove into the Division Threes and did a bunch of research and did my own recruiting. I mean, I wasn't, you know, a standout player at all. So just kind of had to figure it out on my own, really.
All right. So two questions there. I want to go first from a playing standpoint. What did you do to, once you started to think, hey, I want to play college basketball at the Division III level, what did you do as a player to try to improve? Did you have a plan? Did you go the video route? Did you have a trainer that you worked with? What was your process for getting better? So that's the first question. I'll let you answer that in a second. And then the second part I'll come back to is you talked about doing some research on Division III, so we can talk a little bit about that. But first, just go back and talk about, as a player, what you did to try to get yourself ready to for the opportunity to play Division III college basketball.
Okay. I'm going to backtrack a little bit because I feel like I need to include a little bit. So I actually, in my freshman year of high school, I was 5'2", 110. But I was the most skilled kid, you know, in my area at my age and older. And I made the varsity team for a team that was just in two straight state championships. So really good program, historically just a powerhouse in a sense. And I made varsity. And for me, I mean, it was a big accomplishment. But then I just never grew. I went, you know, I was 5'2", 110. My sophomore year, I was 5'4", probably 125. And I'm, you know, at that point, everyone is becoming a man. And I'll never forget, I would look, and this is, I mean, I was weird, but I would look around practice and I would see, all right, like, which of the guys on the team don't have armpit hair just like me? Like, where is anyone else like me, or am I alone in this?
That's so funny.
A late bloomer. So I didn't grow until my senior year. I shot up. I was 5'11", probably when I graduated high school, 5'11", 155. And I grew in college. I'm 6'2", 195 now. So it was kind of, I mean, that I'm sure that had to do with it. And it kind of changed the trajectory of my career because I was extremely skilled. And at a time, my height didn't matter. And my, you know, my athleticism didn't really matter. And then everything, you know, everything caught up to me. And I became, you know, I was behind physically. And it actually, it really affected my mentality. I know it's a long time ago, but when I was coming into high school, I was a scorer. I was very dynamic, took risks. And it was just tough. I kind of had to change my game, became just more of a role player. And I was, you know, for better or worse, like in a way satisfied with that mentality of just being more of a glue guy. I think at times throughout my high school and college career, I could have been more than that, but I guess that's kind of the approach I took. So come my, you know, it was my going into my senior year. No, sorry, going into my junior year was when Division III's got on my radar. My head coach at my high school, Ray Portella, he played at Pomona Pitzer, one of the best academic institutions in the country. And he kind of just told me about his experiences and introduced me to his coach, who is still coaching there, Coach Cat. He might have actually just retired, but I just kind of became really interested. I was just so academic focused my whole life, and I saw this opportunity where I could play the game and have the balance with academics and social life. And I had Division I friends, and I saw how for some people it really wasn't the greatest fit, Division I and Division II, just because it was scholarship. It wasn't always the greatest fit. And I wasn't like one of those kids that was Division I or bust, which is kind of, you know, a common theme nowadays. And I would just, you know, I saw these different schools and how, and really I had no idea, because there aren't any in my area, but these Division III schools, most of them are gorgeous campuses. A lot of the times they're, you know, beautiful facilities, incredible academics, and, you know, different opportunities in that way. Almost they're like all hidden gems. And so at that point, you know, I realized what my limitations were. I looked into some Division IIs. I never had a Division II scholarship or anything like that, but I was, you know, actually thrilled with the fact that I could go to a Division II school and kind of receive that well-balanced experience.
All right. So as you start to do some research, you're in Arizona, and you're looking around, and as you said, if there's not very many Division III schools in Arizona, you know you're going to have to go far from home. And I look at that, we're here in Ohio, and we have a lot of Division IIIs, obviously, as you know, around right here, and we have a lot of Division I's, but we have very few Division IIs or NAIs. So when I was growing up, I looked around the basketball landscape, and I was completely unfamiliar with Division II basketball and NAI basketball because it just wasn't around. And for you, you obviously have to look outside your home area. So when you start doing
your research and you start looking around for places to go, do you remember when you first came across Wooster and what your initial reaction to it was? And then just talk about the process of how you recruited yourself to be able to end up attending the College of Wooster with Coach Moore.
Right. So before I got there, if you looked at the roster at Wooster, it was pretty much going to be all Ohio guys, maybe a Michigan guy in there or one of, Indiana maybe, but never an Arizona guy. And I actually had no idea. I said, College of Wooster, what is this place? I end up finding out that it's called Wooster, College of Wooster. And the reason I found out about it, it was a practice in the winter of my senior year. I get out of practice. My dad calls me and says, hey, come to Arizona Christian University right now. I'm watching this Division III game. So basically, Wooster had come to Phoenix. They do a trip in the winter every year. They came to Phoenix and played Arizona Christian, who was an NAIA, who at the time was really good, and they still are. And then I think it was Vanguard, another West Coast NAIA. Worcester's playing in this game. They're up 14 at half, I'm pretty sure, against Arizona Christian, who ends up being like the number two NAIA in the country. And I mean, it was just, I was watching this basketball. I'm like, there's no way. I my perception in Division III was just skewed because I had never seen it. So I'm watching this like, whoa, this is high level basketball. I mean, athletes and big guys and they're strong and they're completely intense and they're beating up on this high level NAIA team. So I was just really impressed, and they actually end up blowing the lead and they lost the game. I'm pretty sure they lost by two. And Coach Moore and Coach Klein, they were livid. I just remember how upset they were and how passionate they were. But I waited for them after the game, and despite the loss, they were really bummed out. But they spoke to me after the game, and I just introduced myself, and kind of the relationship grew from there. They actually fortunately had a day off the next day, and they all came and watched my practice. And that was the first time I had a college coach in the gym for me. There were a bunch of college coaches in there for my teammates all the time, and that was the first time for me, so that was pretty cool.
What was that like? What was your thought process as you were playing out there during practice and somebody's there actually watching you? Did you feel a little bit nervous? Do you remember what you were going through mentally when that happened?
I don't think I was too nervous, just because I was like really comfortable with my high school and with just kind of, I've always been a good practice player because I just would always give maximum effort and go hard, and that was never really a concern. It's not like I saw them come in the gym and I had to turn it on that day, just because that's my whole life, just kind of been a consistent practice player, for better or worse, because I'd rather have been a good game player than a practice player. But so I wasn't really concerned with that. I remember they came in leading up to, we were playing a game. I think we were in a kind of Christmas time tournament, and we were we were going against the zone. And I, at that point, my shot was just on, and I hit like six straight threes in that practice. And I'm sure for them, that was good. And I just, made plays on defense, and they told me they were interested. They liked me. And then kind of from there, I just started researching this school, and I had no idea, what it was. And I started reading. They advertise they're the top, one of the top undergraduate research institutions. And I thought that was really interesting. I just see an amazing basketball team, and I learned that, they have community that's completely invested in the program. And I just kept learning more and more and more about it. Eventually go out and visit, and just I was wowed, and I end up going there.
So from an academic standpoint, as you're trying to think about what schools you wanted to go to, and clearly you were a good student in high school, what did you think you wanted to study? What did you end up studying at the College of Wooster? And just talk a little bit about what your academic goals were going into your college experience, because I think that's something that it's really important to emphasize for any players who may be out there listening, is how important it is to have good grades and to take care of your academics, because it just opens up so many more opportunities to be able to play college basketball beyond your high school years. If you're limited as a student your opportunities as a player are going to be limited. But if you're a great student, that clearly opens up many more opportunities. So just talk a little bit about your academic background in high school and what you wanted to study when you went to college.
So I was always an overachiever in school. I don't really love that word, but I just kind of like I always had something in me that was like, I'm going to do assignments on time. I'm going to do them well. And that's just kind of how I always approached it. I have an older sister. She's 2 years older and she's brilliant. She's a genius. So she kind of set the standard, like I have to match what she brings. So I just, I studied, I read a lot growing up. I did well in high school. I had above a 4.0 and, my dad is a physical therapist and I watched him my entire life. I was obviously hurt many times or minor injuries and he would treat me and I just was around his practice and I became very interested in that. So I went into college thinking that I would, eventually go to physical therapy school. The weird thing is that, most liberal arts schools like Worcester, there's no pre-physical therapy degree. So my first approach was to go through biology and I thought, I would end up doing pre-physical therapy, but I did not love the biology, did not love the chemistry, the neuroscience. It was difficult. I made it through the first 2 years of it. I did well, but as I slowly started to figure out that I wanted to coach, and the more I read, I became very interested in psychology and I kind of just fully invested myself in psychology also because you can do physical therapy through psychology as long as I had all the prerequisites, which I made up for the community college classes and just did everything I could. But my main focus was psychology and it's for me, I'm extremely happy that I transitioned into that. And so my degree was in psychology from Worcester.
Coaches, we've teamed up with E3 Analytics so you can now purchase 3 of their exclusive new playbooks. If you're looking for ways to improve your team next season, these playbooks blend affordability with the quality content that serious coaches are looking for. Just visit hoopheadspod.com/store and you'll find playbooks from Coach Don Showalter of USA Basketball, Coach Mike Flynn from the Illawarra Hawks in Australia, who coached LaMelo Ball last season, and Coach Tyler Whitcomb from West Michigan Aviation Academy. Check out these great resources at hoopheadspod.com/store.
So you mentioned there that at some point during your college career, coaching starts to appear on your radar, which would make me think that prior to that, it really hadn't been on your radar. So maybe talk about the moment of realization when you thought, hey, maybe when I'm all done, I can start to get into coaching. Maybe coaching is a profession that I want to end up in. When did that thought first enter your mind? And just talk a little bit about the why you thought that might be a good fit.
So I think it begins with just being around really excellent coaches growing up my whole life. My middle school coach, my dad coached middle school with one of our friends, and it was, immediately high level fundamental basketball. My high school coaches were unbelievable. My college coaches, super successful. So I was surrounded by these great coaches. But I just, at the time, I never really considered coaching because I was so consumed by playing and trying to get better. And it wasn't until my sophomore year. So I was starting my sophomore year, probably for the first 12 or so games. So most of the non-conference games, I lost my starting spot. I ended up not playing much. And it kind of was like this downward trajectory. And like most players, naturally, it was really upsetting. I wasn't getting what I wanted. And like many people, one of your main thoughts is, the coach, this, the coach that, So those kind of thoughts actually led me to think, this is what I would do if I was coaching. And at the time, those thoughts were, I was probably thinking the wrong things. They probably weren't, really valid thoughts, but they did kind of, it kind of got me thinking like, oh, this coaching thing's cool. One day, you can call the shots. You decide who plays and what type of players we're going to get and what type of offense. And I started thinking about it. That was at the end of my sophomore year. And then, I really just kind of dove into it. I started reading. I read a bunch of biographies, autobiographies, watched documentaries. I read about different coaches' journeys, Lute Olson, Coach K, Rick Majerus, all these different people, and just to see how they did it. And then I began using this Worcester network that I started to build. So I went to Coach Moore one day. I told him I wanted to coach. And of course, he had given me advice, but he helped connect me to other coaches that were Worcester graduates. So this small school of 2,000 people in a town of 29,000 people has these high-level coaches, and I had no idea. They had Ryan Peden, he's assistant at Ohio State, Lamont Paris, head coach at Chattanooga. Who am I missing here? I don't know. Ellen Wood is at Ashland. I mean, these are high-level coaches all from this small college, and they're, you know, they're right there for me. They have good relationships with Coach Moore. So he, you know, he helped connect me with them, and I just first started by reaching out to them. I had learned that, you know, everyone says, like, don't immediately come out, hey, can you get me a job? And even, you know, I need advice. You know, it's kind of like you have to build these relationships. And I just wanted to introduce myself to them. And, you know, even at this point, I can't say I really know these people, but they have been receptive and really open to talking to me and giving me advice. And so that's kind of how I got into it initially. And then it just, after that, it just exploded. I was all in on coaching. I didn't think for a second again to go to PT school. It was just that was everything for me.
What was it or what is it about coaching that you find to be so attractive? So in other words, when you decided, hey, I'm going to leave physical therapy school behind and I'm going to throw myself all into coaching, and I've been building my network, I've been reading these books, I've been doing all these things, this is the direction that I want to go. What was it about coaching that was so attractive to you? Was there the psychological part of it? Was it the X's and O, the basketball part of it? Was there something else? What stood out for you that said coaching is where I want to be?
So for me, I mean, just having been around the game my entire life in basketball, I mean, it's just been the thing that's just consumed me. I've been infatuated for my entire life. So it was kind of natural. Like I knew I wasn't going to be in the NBA and I wasn't going to play professionally. So I thought it was a natural transition, but I started working guys out a little bit in the off season, and I saw, like, over a few week period, I would see the guys I was working with get better. And that feeling to me was like the best feeling I've ever felt. And I knew that's what I had to do. And even as a player, kind of, it's always kind of been my mentality and my focus of just like getting other guys better. Or helping other guys, getting, you know, swinging it to get another guy's shot. I always, for me, making the extra pass, like that was just as rewarding as a basket. I always was just pass first. I want to see these other guys do well. So that aspect of it, just seeing people get better and watching people have success and being a part of their journey, that to me, and I say that I'm not even close to where I want to be, and I've experienced those things to a very, very small degree, but that's like what I chase every day, being able to impact people. And now I've seen even more. I mean, to me, like the relationship aspect of the game and of, you know, college basketball specifically is what I, you know, really like and what has kind of, you know, fueled this journey for me. As a player, I valued my teammates, I valued my coaches, I valued the community, the fans. It was everything I had to look forward to. And it's the same thing as a coach. I love the people that I work with. I love working with the players and just having an impact on a school and a community. And I think that's just, though, that's been the biggest thing. Like, you see a kid, you know, I've only been in college basketball for 1 year, and I'm not even remotely where I want to be. But you can see how these coaches impact the kid's life, and they can change their entire trajectory. And even like now, like especially today and with everything going on, you can just see the impact of coaches and, you know, that you can have on young men and that you can have on society, really. And that's what it's about for me.
I think that's awesome that you've come to that realization so early in your coaching career. I've said it on the podcast a few times, and that is, for me personally, when I was a young coach, I don't know that I understood the importance of those relationships. Not that I didn't build relationships, but I don't think that I focused on that or thought about that as being one of the driving forces of my job. I much more thought of it being an extension of my knowledge that I had gained as a player.
Right.
And could I pass that knowledge on to the players on my team that I was coaching? And could I help them become better basketball players? And not necessarily worried at all about, could I help them become better people? Or could I use basketball to build a relationship with a kid, which could then impact their life off the floor? I don't think I realized that at all for many, many years early in my coaching career. And the fact that you've been able to recognize that so early, I think is going to give you a tremendous amount of satisfaction as you continue to move forward, because that's something that we all know. You can't win every game, and there's going to be times where you're going to have tough seasons, or you're going to have losing seasons. And if that's all you have, it makes it really, really tough. But you can also latch on to the fact that, sure, our team may be losing, but I can still be having a winning impact on the players on my team through the relationship that I'm building with them and through the things that I'm able to teach them using the game of basketball. And maybe this particular season, it doesn't translate into a winning record, but ultimately, by, as you said, impacting the players that you have in front of you, to me, that makes a huge, huge difference. And the fact that you've been able to recognize that early in your career speaks well for where you're going to end up. So let's talk a little bit about your steps in the process here when you get done and you graduate from Worcester and you're done with your playing career. Talk about your job search when you get done, the process that you went through, who were some of the contacts and people that you talked to that were able to help you, so that if we have somebody who's out there listening, young coaches who maybe are in your same position, they're just getting done with school, or maybe they're early in their career, they're looking to change jobs, or they're looking to move up a level. Just talk a little bit about what your job search was like.
So I'll take it back 1 year before that. So going into my senior year of college, I worked at the Hoop Group, and I had no idea what the Hoop Group was. I was an Arizona guy, and it never really crossed my mind. And I learned that it's this organization that runs camps and exposure events and tournaments, and they bring in, you know, hundreds of college coaches every summer to do that. And I learned that there's different positions that you can be a part of there. And it's, you know, it's just kind of like a, you know, a networking opportunity, an opportunity to work and understand different dynamics of basketball. And I did that going into my senior year. And it was the best decision I've ever made. To this day, I talk to people I met at the Hoop Group every single day. We have a group chat. They're some of my best friends now, the people that I worked with. And it's not easy work. It's long days. And I had to, you know, everyone uses the word grind, and I don't love using it all the time, but that's really what it was. I mean, it was just crazy hours, crazy work. Basically no compensation for what you're doing monetarily. But as far as relationships and beginning to get a glimpse of college basketball and how to work hard, I mean, I wouldn't change it for anything. So that was really the thing that started for me. And now I have friends from the Hoop Group all over the country coaching at all different levels who I have genuine relationships with them, and that's what I take from that the most. So anyone that's trying to get into the industry, and again, I say that like I'm in it. I don't even feel like I'm in it yet, because I'm not, you know, I am not at all where I want to be yet in my career. But that's just the advice to, you know, where I'm at this point. That's what I would give to someone who wants to kind of take a similar route and get into coaching. That the Hoop Group was amazing. Really great people, great organization and events, and a ton of college coaches and opportunities to network and learn from different people. So that was to begin, that was the biggest step for me towards kind of getting in a little bit.
How did you get connected with them? Did you reach out to them? Did somebody recommend you reach out to them? Did they talk to Coach Moore? How did that connection come to give you the opportunity to go out and work there?
I think I saw something on, maybe it was on Hoop Dirt. I don't think they just reached out to me. So one of the elite directors, Cooper Handelsman, he coaches at Brown now. He played at Kenyon, so I played against him. So maybe it was him that reached out to me. But it, you know, it was an internship, and I thought internship, like, that's awesome. That's such a buzzword, you know. I'm an intern. I'm going to be great. And it just, I mean, it was hard work, and it wasn't exactly what I thought. I mean, we were calling kids and calling families all day trying to recruit them to camp. I mean, we were cold calling, and that's not exactly what I thought we were doing. And I'll tell you, a lot of times I was miserable, and I thought, like, why am I doing this? But I look back on it now, and it was the best decision I could have ever made. I learned, you know, I mean, it just takes, you know, discipline and just having to kind of be persistent. And I mean, I wasn't the best at it. I did, there were times where I was, you know, just not extremely positive about doing that every day, but it taught me a lot, and I met incredible people. So again, it was like one of those things. I wasn't, you know, it's not, I don't know how much of a, like, sought after internship it is. I mean, people, it's definitely worth doing, and I would recommend it to anyone, but it's not like, I don't think it's super competitive or anything, but I saw it as a good opportunity. Again, it was in Reading, Pennsylvania, and I'm, you know, used to summers in Phoenix and the West Coast and, you know, warm weather, but beautiful weather. And then I'm taking myself to this place in the summer at Albright College, and it was just kind of like a shock and totally different and uncomfortable, but it was the best thing for me.
Yeah, to be able to put yourself in a position where, one, you get an opportunity to network with lots of different people and build those relationships. And I think that's something that is so important. And when I look back on my young coaching career, that's one of the regrets that I have, is I kind of was somewhat insular in what I did. I didn't really go to coaching clinics. I didn't go and work camps. When I was out of school, I started my own camps here in Cleveland and was working and doing some camps for elementary school kids, but I could have been much better served to start and do my own camps, but also to go and work at some other camps, not only to network, but also just to learn how to do things better and different and add to what I was already doing. And the fact that you were able to see that and be able to network, I think, is something that probably has served you well to this point, but is going to continue to serve you well. The better relationships that you can build when you're young, we all know that in the coaching profession, many times when you start talking about who gets what job, a lot of times it comes down to who knows who and who lets somebody know that this job is open or it's going to be open or somebody's moving to take another job and that allows you to move into that job. And those relationships are really important. And the second thing that I pull out of your story is a theme that's run through our podcast with conversations with a lot of coaches. And that is that even though you may have been doing something that you didn't love, making those cold calls, I'm pretty sure that when you were sitting there on the phone that you were doing the best job that you possibly could in the moment. And I think that's a lesson that we've tried to get across to coaches, players, whoever it may be, that you've got to do the best job that you possibly can in whatever situation you're in. And if you do, chances are somebody is going to notice that. And maybe the next time there's a little bit better opportunity, they think about you because they remember that you worked hard when they saw you in this other opportunity. And that's how things happen. And I think that when I hear what you're talking about and I hear you working at the Hoop Group and I hear you doing things that I'm not sure that was the most fun thing, but I still tried my best. To me, there's a huge lesson there, especially for young coaches, is to make sure that whatever job you're in, even though it might not be the one that it's not your dream job, maybe you're not the head coach at Duke right now, but you still got to put in the work. You still got to put in the effort. You still got to be the best that you possibly can in whatever position you're in. If you do that, that's going to allow you to have success. And I think that's the lesson that I take away from what you just shared. And I don't know if that's a similar lesson that you learned through the course of that experience.
Absolutely. And I think beyond that, for me, it's just the relationship. I mean, for the most part, the relationships. My class of interns and people that I worked with are now many, you know, different roles in college basketball, high school basketball, professional basketball. I mean, they're just in different places. And that's what I take from it more, just a really good base of friends. And then I think about, you know, in 20 years or in 10 years or whatever it is, so, you know, these guys will be getting jobs and hopefully people that, you know, would recommend me and that I could recommend or that we could work together. I mean, you just never know with that type of thing. I think probably the one thing that stood out for me at the time. See, we're making these cold calls, and you know, at a certain point, I was pretty burnt out and miserable, and you know, you didn't really understand what the purpose of it all was. But one of my bosses would say, I don't know where this quote comes from, but he would say, if you're too big for the small jobs, you're probably too small for the big jobs. And I kind of just took that and kind of tried to adopt that mindset. Like, no one wants to do, you know, the dirty work, but everyone has to start somewhere, especially if you're a former mediocre Division III player, 6-1 division. Like, you have to start somewhere. And when I say like, I'm not at all where I want to be yet, it's not like I'm where I am currently is exactly like, I think it's a great situation and I'm very happy with where I'm at. But I mean, in just the landscape of things, like, I haven't made it. Like, I can't say that the advice I give is the best advice because I haven't won the games. I haven't coached, I haven't recruited, but those are all things that I wish to do and that I aim to do.
Yeah, I completely understand. I think what comes across when you're talking about these things is the fact that you have some ambition moving forward because you love the coaching profession and you want to continue to advance, which is completely understandable. And yet at the same time, everything that you shared indicates that you're doing the best job that you possibly can in the job that you have now. And I can tell you from the experiences that I've had personally and from the experiences that coaches have shared on the podcast over the course of the past 2 years that we've been doing this, that's exactly the right path for any young coach to take, is to build your network, take different jobs that give you different experiences, do the best job you possibly can at those particular jobs. And then through your network, through that hard work, people are going to notice the jobs that you're doing, and that's what's going to open the next door. I think a lot of times what we get in trouble is not focusing on what we're doing and what's right in front of us, but instead having one eye out the door looking for, well, what's going to happen next and why am I not getting this next opportunity, instead of saying, I got to make the most of the opportunity that's in front of me. And I think that's the lesson that I'd want to take away from your story and from what you've been able to do. Did you ever get anybody to sign up on a cold call? Did you get anybody signed up for camp?
Oh yeah, that's always. I mean, a lot of the time we did. And I mean, there were days though. I remember a particular day where we had some competition of get, you know, can you get, or how many people you get signed up, and there was a running total. And that day, I couldn't get anyone. And I remember feeling like that. Even to this day, it haunts me. Like, I really, you know, I really underperformed there. But there were times you have to talk someone out of, you know, there's someone screaming on the phone, you have to calm them down. So even learning like those interpersonal skills of like how to deal with people and, you know, how to essentially sell them something. But it was nice because we're selling a good product. So it wasn't like I had to just, you know, lie about something I didn't believe in. Like, I knew that they brought a lot of college coaches. I knew they give kids opportunities. So it was something that was, you know, not extremely difficult to sell. But we were calling on 4th of July. We were calling at 8 a.m. We're calling at 8 p.m. So, yeah, definitely. I mean, it was, like I said, I think the best thing that I could have done at that point.
Where'd that list of names and numbers come from?
So it would be, I mean, they have their own database, but, you know, it's all AAU team. I'm sure they get it from, somehow compile it from AAU tournaments and high school tournaments, but they have, you know, a running database of all these players. I mean, it's basically everyone in the country, I would think, but they have, I mean, they have a lot of, you know, it's contact information and emails and phone numbers. And you're sometimes you'll call people and you'll say, hey, is Mark, you think Mark would be interested in camp this year? And they'd say, sorry, Mark's 26 now. He's not going to exposure camp. So like, you'd be calling sometimes they're, you know, hey, so yeah. So that's, yeah, there were some funny calls stuff.
That's funny. All right. So let's jump ahead from there. And now you're in the job market and you're looking for obviously a more permanent position. So talk a little bit about what that search was like based off the experience that you got at Hoop Group, the network that you started to build. How does the opportunity that you ended up taking with the Dallas Mavericks, how does that come to pass? Just give us a little breakdown of the job hunt.
So I'd been kind of in communication with a bunch of different people, junior year, senior year, but it was mostly just getting advice. And I was, I was loving it. I mean, people, I was shocked at how willing people were to talk to someone they didn't know. And I just felt like I just tried to latch on to different people and absorb everything they gave me. So that was really big for me in kind of understanding the process and how it worked. And I knew how competitive it was, and I wasn't delusional about anything. I understood, you know, what I would have to do. And the first job I applied to was in April of my senior year, 2018. And I applied, it was a Division III GA job. And I went and interviewed, you know, I thought it went well. I wasn't like super thrilled with the position or anything, but I, you know, it was a good school, a good program, really good conference. And I figured, you know, okay, like I could take this. And I actually didn't get the job. And that was a pretty big bummer for me, because I thought, oh, if I can't get a Division III GA, then, you know, I might not get, you know, where I want to be. So I was, not for a long time. I didn't let it discourage me, but I was a little bit bummed about that. But then I saw this opening. My high school coach sent me a link. It was on Hoop Dirt or Teamwork Online, one of those websites, and it was for this Dallas Mavericks player development internship. And I didn't think I had a connection to the Mavericks. I loved the NBA, and I'd watched a ton of Suns basketball, so I watched, you know, a lot of Mavericks basketball, different playoff battles, all of that. So I was always interested, and I saw the opportunity, and I thought, I have to apply. So the first thing I did was I went through my network of people. I had a contact list. I made a contact list of different people, where they were at, who they were associated with. And the person that I ended up figuring out that I had a connection to Dallas Mavericks, because Coach Dave Grube was always coming to Worcester to our practices. You had him on last week, and I listened to it, and he's an amazing guy, and he's been a really, really great mentor to me, and he's kind of helped me along this way, and I'm just absorbed everything he said, because he's done it at different levels. He worked his way up. He was a middle school coach, and he, you know, elementary school coach, worked his way up, Division III, Division I, so he's done it, and he connected me with Larry Shiat. Larry Shiat was previously at Wyoming. He was the head coach, you know, defensive-oriented, tough-minded coach. He had a lot of success there. He produced NBA players there. He was on Florida's staff with Billy Donovan. He has championships. He was at Clemson, like super successful and well-respected coach. And he was an assistant coach of the Dallas Mavericks at the time, and he just so happened to be a Worcester alum. So Coach Grube connected us with Coach Shy and I, and he was, again, he doesn't know me. It's the guy, he's in the NBA. What's like, why does he have to talk to some kid? And right away, he was super authentic. He was very straightforward. He told me how competitive of an internship it was. He said a couple thousand people are going to apply. You're going to be going up against former college players, former pro players, people with, you know, their family, you know, parents in coaching that are more well connected than you. But because you reached out to me, and because I trust Coach Grube, and because it's early enough and you're the first one that's reached out to me, I'll vouch for you. And because you're a Worcester guy, I'll vouch for you. So, you know, he didn't even really know me before that. And he took the chance on me. And there was, so at that time, there were three, three interviews. There were two calls, and I made it through both of those. They were pretty straightforward. And then we had an in-person interview. That was in May, and I think they brought in, I mean, so they had a couple thousand applicants. They brought in probably 50 guys, it sounded like. And, you know, I was lucky enough that, you know, just, I guess I made a decent impression in the interview. I really think that Coach Larry Shiat he was the sole reason I got that job. I'm not sure. They could have just skipped through my application if he didn't say something and if he didn't vouch for me. So that's, again, something I learned about, you know, they say like it's about who you know. And I was fortunate enough to be connected to him. And it's funny, I look at it now, like the only reason I worked for the Mavericks, and perhaps the only reason I'm at Duquesne today, was because I went to some small college in the middle of nowhere in Ohio, coming from Phoenix, Arizona. Like, the story doesn't even really make sense to me, but it worked out, and you know, I'm just grateful for that.
Who was in the interview? So when you go in and you interview with the Mavericks, who are the people, what are their titles that are interviewing for those positions? Is it somebody from the coaching staff? Is it front office? Is it who's actually sitting down and doing that interview process with you?
So kind of the main two people that spearheaded that program were, the one who started it was Mike Procopio.
Right.
He was the head of player development there. I mean, he's got a history in basketball. He worked with Kobe during his championship runs. He worked with Jordan before that, and his trainer. I mean, he had a great resume, and he was very well respected. And he started this program basically bringing in interns to rebound, to pass, to do scout team, to hop in on defense, hop in drills, anything basketball related, practices, pregame, postgame, workouts, training camp. You were there essentially to be a manager. I mean, you're rebounding, you're wiping the floor when a sweat drops. I mean, it wasn't like some glorious position, but I was extremely grateful to have it. And then the other, so that it was Mike Procopio, and then the other guy was a front office guy, Terry Sullivan, and they kind of spearheaded it. And they're, I mean, two really good people and good bosses.
Yeah, we've had Mike on the podcast. He's awesome. I mean, the things that he's doing now with his hoop consultants and the film breakdown and what he's sharing, I just found him to be an extremely bright guy and somebody who, again, through the power of his hard work and just continuing to work and do the things that are necessary to gain the players' respect and the tremendous work ethic that he had paid off. And as you said, the guys that he's been able to work with in his career are just tremendous. And for you to be able to get that opportunity, and again, Coach Shiat, he was actually, when back a long time ago, he was an assistant coach at Cleveland State. My dad was a teacher, a professor down at Cleveland State, so I used to go to games. And I'm sure that I met Coach Shiat at some point. I don't remember any particular interaction with him. I more remember my dad talking about him when he was an assistant at Cleveland State. And it's just amazing how small the basketball world is. And you have Coach Grube, who was assistant all 4 years I was at Kent. And then here's a guy who just is retired, lives in Worcester, comes to practices, gets connected to you. All of a sudden, he's connecting you with somebody else. And then before you know it, you've got a job as a result of those connections. It's kind of an amazing process. So talk a little bit about maybe just one or two of the highlights of your time with the Mavericks. What did you enjoy about the job? What was difficult about it? Just kind of give us a feel for what exactly you were doing. I know you kind of compared it to maybe a managerial position, like a college manager, but just maybe give us some insight as to just day to day, kind of what were some of the things that you did beyond what you already described.
So, well, the first thing I'll say is about Pro, I mean, that's Mike Procopio, that's what we call him, Pro, was that he was the best possible boss that I could have had my first year out of school and trying to get, you know, into coaching. He, like, more and be, it was beyond the player development aspect, because that was a really big part of it. And we had film breakdown sessions, and we're partaking in the workouts every single day, so we're seeing it, you know, what he's doing, and he would talk to us and educate us. And that was, I mean, I took a ton from that. But his biggest thing was about professionalism. And that was really huge for me, because I hadn't been in that role before, and I didn't know, you know, he was all about just, you know, not promoting, no self-promotion, which is funny because now I'm on a podcast talking about myself, but he was all about coming to work, being on time, being there early, simply doing your job. Don't try to do anything extra. Don't try to stand out. By standing out, you're hurting yourself. He talked about, you know, certain aspects like don't have your phone in, don't be on social media, don't be taking pictures, because we were like an accessory. We were lucky. We were the only team in the NBA that had this program. So anything that we could do to jeopardize that, you know, just we avoided it. And that was really the best thing for me, because that's how I kind of approach. I mean, it was almost like a militant way, but he was looking out for us. I mean, he was teaching us how to work hard and how to just put our heads down and be in a role of, you know, just to serve. That was the biggest thing. Like, we were in a support role. We're not calling shots. We're not in the huddles. We're not on the private planes, and we're not in the locker room. Like, we are there to support their roles and make everything more efficient. So I guess basically what we would do, so like if they had a noon practice, there'd be guys that would, you know, come in and shoot before. Let's say they came in as early as 9. So we would be in there at 7 or 7:30. So we would get there a long time before then, just to make sure that if someone wanted to shoot, if someone wanted to get a workout in, we were ready to go. So there were 10 of us, and we would just rotate and just be there to help. I mean, essentially the job was rebounding for them, passing to them, hopping in drills, whether it's offensively or defensively, giving them a look, and then practice, again, aiding, you know, we're running the clock, we're standing in formation, precisely arranged around the court. If there's a drop of sweat, you are sprinting out there, wiping it as fast as you can, because if someone slips on that court, it's your fault. So it's all things like those were little jobs, and it you know, you just had to take them seriously, because no matter how small they were, and no matter, like, we weren't getting rewarded, and we shouldn't have gotten rewarded, but because we were just fortunate enough and we were privileged enough to be in that position, but we just understood, like, that's what we had to do to you know, help the organization. And I feel really, really lucky to have been able to experience that.
So what were some things that you took away from a coaching standpoint in terms of things you learned from Mike about player development that you can continue to take and move forward with in your career? So now you get to Duquesne, or you get to whatever, you know, stops you're going to have in your future career. What are some things that you learned from him that you can apply when you work with players moving forward?
So his thing and his phrase is dominate simple. And I think, like, that's one of the things that I've completely tried to embody. So by that, he basically just taught us that it's not, you know, the game isn't super complicated. When it comes down to it, in player development and in trying to help people improve upon their skills, you know, it doesn't take rocket science. Everything needs to be game-like. So I just started watching him and learning from him and seeing that, you know, it's really not as complex as some people make it. And when you're in this era of social media and self-promotion, and everyone has to be unique and everyone has to stand out, like, there's times where I look and think, like, you know, are they really getting better? Is it just time spent in the gym, or are they improving? And I really just learned in that sense that just keep it simple, keep it game-like. So everything that I've tried to do after that point has been game oriented. What are they going to see in the game? Why would we ever take a shot or work on a move that they're not going to see in the game? At the same time, you do want to allow a player to grow, and you don't want to put limitations on someone. And there's time and place to explore and to experiment and to try to take jumps in your game. But for the most part, I mean, it's pretty simple. And the other thing that Pro really taught us was there's, you know, 70% of the league, if not more, I don't know the exact number he uses, but they're role players. Not everyone is Kyrie Irving. Not everyone is Kevin Durant. Not everyone has to be or should be at all a 12 dribble isolation, top of the key, step back like James Harden. Like, not everyone's built for that. There's only so many stars and superstars. So you have to work on skills that can translate to these different roles. So we're looking at a wing player, and you know, if you're a role player that is playing the wing position, we're looking at transition baskets, and we're looking at shot fake one dribble drives, and being able to hit spot ups and shot fake sidestep. And beyond that, I mean, it's and obviously being a very capable defender at that level, you have to be. But, like, it's pretty simple. So he taught us, you know, focusing on 1 to 2 to 3 skills and just mastering them. And I think that's just, like, he brought back the simplicity of the game, the purity of the game for me. So Pro, that's, I mean, that and watching his player development, that was just one experience. And they also have, I mean, they have incredible coaches on the whole staff. God Sham God is another one of the player development coaches. I watched him every day. his coaching and teaching philosophy is completely different from pros, who was also different from other guys. There's Pete Patton. He's the shooting coach over there. I learned a ton from him regarding shooting. And so there are all these different coaches with different styles. And then there's Rick Carlisle, who's the head coach. So he's less, player development oriented, more team strategy and team execution. And to be able to watch him and implement, I'm watching him implement an offense and, watching that every day was unbelievable. I felt like I was a fly on the wall, and I tried to absorb everything. I tried to write down everything I could and just learn from him. And that's a championship coach. And that's one of the long, I think he's probably the second longest tenured coach in the NBA behind Popovich, maybe Popovich, then him, then Spoelstra, or something in that order. But I mean, just such an incredible basketball mind. He played for the Boston. People forget he played for the Boston Celtics back in the day. I mean, this guy is complete champion. So to learn from him and just see like his was most X's and O's, and watching that and how he approached, all of them, watching how they approach player relationships. So they had one of the more like defensive assistant coaches. I mean, he did both, but very defensive minded was Jamal Mosley. And he was just watching him and how he worked with the players and how he approached relationships. That was, again, one of the things I learned. Like, you can't treat every guy the same at all, and you have to coach them differently. Mose did a really, really good job of that. So that was just, the whole experience was unbelievable. I really felt like I was a fly on the wall, and I just tried to soak it all up. I didn't, it wasn't about like, And initially, you walk in and you see Dirk and you see Luka and you see these guys that you've been watching your entire life. And I'm a total hoop junkie. I'm seeing, Michael Finley's part of the organization and Jason Kidd's walking in. And there's, it's just all these basketball legends. And at first, you're like completely wowed by it. But like Pro Tatis, this is your job. Like, you're not here to be a fanboy. You're here to learn, and you're here mainly to contribute and help the efficiency of the organization. So I tried to, that's just part of professionalism. And, I really respect all of those guys and people in the NBA, but it's not, it's not a time to idolize them and to be fans of them. It's just a time to get to work. So that was kind of the approach that I took.
All right. So I want to ask you about the practices. So when you're are you attending most of, and obviously during the season, NBA teams aren't doing a whole lot of practicing, but when the team's at home during the season or when it's training camp, are you not only there for the player development stuff pre and post practice, but are you physically present there in the actual team practices as well?
Yeah. So anything on court at home, we were there. So we didn't travel. We weren't in the locker room. We weren't even in the huddles, which is fine. We shouldn't be, but we were on the court at all times. So in practice, it was really cool. I had the opportunity to be a part of the scout team. So I played the point guard for the scout team. So when the Mavs were playing against the Trailblazers, I was, I was either CJ McCollum or Damian Lillard, or if we were playing the Rockets at that time, Chris Paul was on the Rockets, I was Chris Paul. And we were, so not only were we exposed to our own offense and different philosophies that Coach Carlisle taught, we were also exposed to all these different types of offenses. And it's just so, NBA offenses to me are just like, they're just advanced, and it's playing with pace, and it's a lot of different, there's just so much more space in the NBA. And also no defensive 3 seconds, and it's very pick and roll oriented. So I'm running off, I'm trying to give them the best look possible. I'm going off a pick and roll, acting like I'm Chris Paul, and I'm very far from Chris Paul, and I'm going against DeAndre Jordan's protecting the rim. And it was unbelievable, but it helped me see the game too. And it helped me learn, the amount of philosophies I learned, and their, the way these guys have to communicate, and the different, the different defensive coverages on pick and roll coverage. And, it was just unbelievable being exposed to concepts that I didn't know, but I could pick up through actually being on the court.
Yeah, I can imagine that having that opportunity to be able to see that type of behind the scenes work with the coaching staff, with the players, and then being able to soak that all in was tremendously valuable. So I have two questions, one related to that, and then something that is not quite as sophisticated of a question. So the first question is, when you were in those practices and you're mentally going through and thinking about some of the things that you're learning, what was your process for collecting all that information and making sure that you didn't forget it? Did you create a notebook? Did you create a computer file? What was your system for collecting all the information that you were gathering as you were going through that experience?
Yeah, so I had a notebook on me always. And so you could, I mean, if you were between workouts, you could run back to the table where you had your notebook or run back to the little lockers and, you know, jot down the notes. The nice thing was we had, you know, everything was recorded, so I could go back and rewatch workouts. I still do that to today. I'll rewatch Mavericks practices and workouts and just try to, you know, get ideas and see it. Because to be honest, at first, I mean, with the pace of everything and the introduction of new terminology and new concepts, like I couldn't pick up on certain things, and I couldn't focus on, and I still, you know, it's a challenge to focus on both offensive, defensive ends. So, you know, just to be able to rewatch all of that really helped me. And I'm still learning from it today. I try to watch a player development workout session from the Mavericks, and from my experience, I try to watch those almost daily.
All right. So here's my less sophisticated question. And that question is, what was something that was surprising to you about NBA players that maybe you didn't expect? Was there something that stood out to you about them? It could be collectively just as an entire group, or maybe something about a particular player or a group of players that just you were like, oh man, I didn't know that they were like this, or I didn't realize they were normal when it came to that, or I didn't realize they were so abnormal when it came to this. Just maybe something surprising that you learned about either a group of players or one particular player.
I guess there were a few things. I mean, you just, until you see them up close, you don't realize how incredibly athletic a lot of them, most of them are, you know, even how just physically how strong. Like we worked the games and we would see these opposing teams like Damian Lillard. Like I didn't realize how strong he was. Eric Gordon for the Rockets. I had no clue. This guy he's huge. So just physically, like seeing these guys, I mean, they're big and they're strong. And there's a clear difference between a college athlete and an NBA player. So in that sense, I wasn't surprised by that, but I was just it was pretty fascinating. But in addition to that, I would just say the IQ of these guys. And I look at veterans in the NBA and people that have had careers. I mean, I don't know how long the average career in the NBA is. I think it's only a few years. But the guys like Devin Harris, who are like longtime vets, JJ Barea, and what separates guys like that, and I mean, a ton of vets in the league. You look at Jared Dudley and Richard Jefferson late in his career, like he was 40 years old still playing. Vince Carter still playing. These guys are so smart and they have insane basketball awareness and basketball knowledge that has carried them, on top of them being really good locker room guys, which I can't speak on behalf of those guys regarding their leadership, like not directly on the court, like locker room stuff. I can't speak to that because I wasn't involved with that, but my guess is that they provide that as well. So really just seeing like how smart these guys, to be in the league, you have to figure it out because there's a bunch of different coverages for different people. There's different reads, different looks, and there's different philosophies and terminology. So you just have to be smart. You have to be engaged. You have to be able to be focused. And I was just really the intensity of that was something that stood out to me. And then I guess in addition to that is just like seeing up close the killer mindset and that kind of like that mentality and just tough-nosed people. The person that stands out to me most is Jalen Brunson. So I was there for his rookie season. He came off of a national championship. I mean, he's the best player in college basketball, but still was doubted. He's a second round pick, you know, doesn't have great size. Maybe people thought he wasn't a point guard. They didn't know if he was a point guard or a combo guard or a shooting guard. He wasn't super athletic, but you look back, this guy's been a winner at every single level. He's dominated at every level. And just to watch him every single day, he was completely fearless. He was going up against, you know, big time players and he was going directly at them. every single time, never back down. And he had the beginning of his rookie year was he was not efficient, but he got in the gym and he worked and worked and worked, and his shot got better. And he was, and you could tell like his feel for the game is, he's incredible. I'm a huge fan of his just because it seems like he does it the right way. And in addition to that, just like the hard work. I mean, at every level and every kind of like the different places I've been, I just keep being exposed to how hard people work. And I'm like, how is it possible to even work harder than that? I mean, he's got like watching Harrison Barnes, like that guy, I mean, complete gym rat. He was in there all the time. And even like Dirk, and I, again, like I don't want to reveal these secrets that I feel like aren't, not, they're not even secrets, but things that aren't for me to reveal because I feel like I was just a fly on a wall and it was just a privilege for me to be there. But a guy like Dirk in his last season, like he was still working harder than anybody in a sense that if they had practice at 10, he was there at 7 every single time doing mobility and doing stretching and doing whatever is part of his rehab. So just to see that, I mean, the work ethic, I mean, it's unparalleled. You know, there's a reason these guys are in the league and there's a reason that they stay in the league. And it's because of that, that work ethic being a huge part of it.
Yeah, I think you hit on a lot of things that the average person who is maybe just a fan of the NBA doesn't necessarily realize. And it starts with the physical gifts that these guys have from a size standpoint, from a speed, quickness, wingspan, all these things. If you have not had an opportunity to go down and be on the floor for an NBA game or an NBA practice or stand next to an NBA player, now granted, there are some guys who may look like Steve Nash who aren't necessarily physically imposing, but 95% of the guys in the league, when you stand next to them, you have at least some sense physically of what makes them different from, even as you said, the best college players. I mean, there's just a difference. There's just a physical difference in what those guys bring to the table. That's number one. Then number two, the second thing you said was how high a player's basketball IQ has to be in order for them to stick in the league. And the guys who are around for a long time are guys who figure it out. As you talked about earlier with Mike Procopio, saying that 70% of the league is made up of role players. You got to figure that out. You got to figure out that you're a role player and get really good at playing that role. And that takes intelligence and that takes basketball IQ. And then I think the last piece you touched on is the work ethic. And the work ethic clearly is what separates guys who have the physical tools. Maybe they have the mental makeup, but you don't get to the highest level and stay there if you don't have a work ethic. Maybe if you have the physical tools and you have some skill, you can stick around for a year, 2 years, 3 years, just based off your talent. But eventually that catches up to you and you get replaced by somebody who's going to do things right and is going to work hard. And I think you did a really good job of summarizing for all of us what that looks like from an NBA level. And I think there's lessons to be taken, whether you're a high school player, you could be a college player, that everybody can work on improving their basketball IQ. Everybody can have a great work ethic. Those are things that are within your control. The physical tools that you have, just like I think back to the beginning of your story, when you're a 5'2", 115-pound freshman, you know, you can't control that. There's not much you can do about that, but you certainly could control how hard you worked on your skills, and you certainly could control the amount of effort that you put into everything that you were doing. And when you do that, that enables you to maximize whatever physical gifts that you have. And for the most part, NBA players, yeah, they have a lot of physical gifts, but they also maximize those physical gifts. Those guys at the highest level, I always come back to, I'm a Jordan guy, and I always have been. And obviously the Last Dance cemented that for me even more. But what I always said about Jordan was that here's a guy who was given a tremendous amount of physical gifts. I mean, there's a guy who his body was built to play basketball. And yet at the same time, his work ethic and his insane competitiveness and just the way that he drove himself allowed him to maximize those gifts. And that's what made him the best player ever. And if you take away one of those components, he doesn't get to be the greatest ever. If he has all the tools, but he doesn't work insanely hard, he doesn't get there. If he works insanely hard, but he doesn't have those physical tools, he tops out somewhere below being the greatest player of all time. And it's just, I think the average person doesn't necessarily recognize that when it comes to NBA players. And I thought you did a really good job of laying that out. Let's move from your experience with the Mavs. That internship ends. What do you do there? What's the step? What's the next step in the process for thinking about where you want to go, what you want to do? Just talk about what happened when the internship was over. What opportunities did you look for? What opportunities presented themselves? And just tell us the story of how you ended up at Duquesne.
So I am going to rewind real quick just to add to that, because you brought up the Jordan documentary and just kind of made my mind go. But just watching that documentary, to me, there was a big focus on, like, they talked a lot about Rodman, and they talked a lot about Steve Kerr and even Pippen. And so it's just talking about these people who, especially like Rodman, is just the perfect example, someone who took on this role and just mastered it. And it was the role that no one wanted. It was the dirtiest role. And I look at guys in the league now, like I look at Dwight Powell, who plays for the Mavericks, who's made a lot of money in the NBA, and he's not a household name, but he's one of the best statistically and just visually, he's one of the best role men in the NBA as far as rolling to the basket. Incredibly good timing. He's a smart player, and he just fills his role. He plays hard. He plays with an insane motor, and he's made a lot of money doing that. And Dorian Finney-Smith, another name that probably goes over a lot of people's heads, undrafted, just kind of fought his way, clawed his way into the league, accepted a role of, you know, basically 3-and-D, really worked on his shot, you know, good rebounder at like 6-7 guard essentially, and got himself paid. And that's just kind of a trend I'm seeing, that, you know, if you can fill a role, it doesn't have to be the star role, but if you can master that role and become one of the best at it, it could be something small like offensive rebound. Tristan Thompson got paid, I don't know, 70 plus million to offensive rebound. He switched his hands in the middle of the career. He decided, yeah, I'm not a lefty, I think I'm a righty. And he's still getting paid, you know, he probably has 100 plus million dollars collected playing in the NBA. I mean, that's incredible to me. It's because he got paid for his motor. So that's one thing I wanted just to add as far as just something I saw in the league and that I kind of continue to observe.
No, that makes total sense. I think when you see guys, especially for you, having to get to see them up close and personal every single day, and to be able to witness the IQ piece of it and the work ethic piece of it, which most times for the average fan of the NBA, those things are hidden away. Fans don't get to see those things. Yeah, we get to see what happens on game night, but we don't get to see what happens with those players on the practice floor and the off season, and just the way they put in the time on their body and their mind and getting to practice and getting extra shots up and doing the things that they know they need to do in order to be able to stay in the league. The average person just doesn't see that. So my next question again is, what happens when the internship ends? Just describe the next steps in your coaching career and kind of how you moved forward after the internship ended.
So the whole year, I mean, the internship, you come in with the understanding that it's a 1-year program. Like, you are there to learn a lot and to meet people and build your network and then move on. That's the understanding. So the whole time you're trying to connect with other people in the league, and you're trying to use that NBA, although, I mean, it's an internship and it's, you know, you're at the bottom of the ladder, but it's still, you still have the NBA on your resume. So you're trying to leverage that at that time and just reaching out to a bunch of different people. And really during that process, I didn't know what level I wanted to be. I thought about the NBA. I thought about the G League. I thought about Division III. I thought about a Division I GA. I thought about these different options. I just kind of was really open-minded. So I reached out to a bunch of different people in the same way that I did when I was in college, just trying to get advice, trying to get a connection. And really the first major hit for me was from Duquesne. One of the GA, the old GA at Duquesne, was a hoop group guy. So one of my friends from the hoop group told me, hey, so-and-so, his name is Chad, he's leaving, you know, he's done with his graduate assistantship and they're going to need someone, so I'll connect you with him. And that was in April. So pretty early, like in the landscape of like the job market in basketball. the college season had just ended. I only knew Duquesne because I watched a lot of Arizona basketball, University of Arizona, and TJ McConnell came from Duquesne. That was pretty much my exposure to Duquesne. I didn't know much about it. Fortunately, my mom is actually from Pittsburgh, so I had been to Pittsburgh. It had been a while, but you know, I knew the city. I knew it was a decent city, at least, and I've found out it's actually a great city. But I went out, so I kind of connected with them, and just, you know, was lucky enough to go out there for an interview. It went very well, and after a week or so, they got back to me and told me, you know, they offered me the job, and I didn't accept it right away. No, actually, excuse me, I did, because leading up to that point, so for like right after the interview, I thought, you know, I actually did pretty well. I think we connected. It was a great experience. Like, this is the job that I want. And I was pretty sure about it. But I called my mentors. I called Larry Shia. He said, if you get this job offer, you have to take it. I called Adam Cohen from Stanford. He's associate head coach at Stanford. Very familiar with Dan Braun. They have the same mentor and coach Ben Braun. But he said, same thing. You get this job, you have to take it. And I talked to probably five different people that said the same thing. So when they offered me the job, it was a no-brainer. He called me. I was in Dallas still at the time. It was probably May 2nd, something like that. Offered me the job, and I took it. And I didn't even, you know, I could have explored other things. I made, you know, people kind of chase like the highest level, and I was looking at some like high major entry level stuff and MBA stuff. But it just seemed like the right move. And I'm extremely glad that I did it.
So for people who don't know what exactly your role is as an assistant coach, just describe for us what it means when you're a graduate assistant, you're a video coordinator. What is your day-to-day responsibilities look like? What are you doing? I'm sure it's a jack of all trades, but just tell us a little bit about what your day-to-day look like.
Right. So, I mean, the graduate assistant spot will differ from, you know, in different places. Like some schools have, let's say, five graduate assistants, and they're all like a little more specific roles, and other schools might have one, and it could be someone doing absolutely everything. We have two at Duquesne, so it's me and another guy, but at the same, I mean, we're doing everything. We have our hand in absolutely everything. So it's, you know, we're eating dirt. So I'm, you know, driving people around and ordering food for the guys and, doing the gear bundles and all these different, helping with academics. I mean, it's, you know, you have to just do the jobs that no one else wants to do, and that, but the things that have to be done, they have to be done well, and they have to be done efficiently. So it's just kind of those type of things. As we got closer to the season, we lost our video coordinator the year before. He had left, and they didn't hire another video guy. And no one on staff knew how to do video or really had any background in it, and either did I. But I saw that kind of as an opportunity to gain value and to learn, really. I mean, if I'm using a lot of video and analyzing it and breaking it down, I'm sure I'll be learning a lot. So I kind of just taught myself the software, used different resources, different people, just to learn it quickly. And by the beginning of the season, I was the graduate assistant, but I was taking on the video coordinator responsibilities like full time. So then my job basically became solely breaking down film, exchanging film with different teams, with our coaches, helping out with different, you know, helping out with scouting reports, showing, you know, watching film with our guys, you know, doing film sessions before practice, after practice, you know, pregame, things like that. So it really became film oriented. But on top of that, still like the day, I mean, I'm still eating dirt, like still ordering food for guys and driving people places. And, you know, it's just the things that have to be done. And really the special thing, though, about the graduate assistant position is that you're allowed to be on the court with the guys probably more than anyone. Support staff is limited in their access to the court. But because I was a graduate assistant, like I can work guys out all the time, and I love the player development aspect of it. So, you know, I'd be on the court with guys, you know, work guys out before practice, after practice, come back at night. So I really, so far, have gotten just a well-rounded experience. Coach Dambrot has been just incredible to work for, and I'm sure I'll touch on that a little more later. But he's just given me responsibility, and, you know, it started off with small things, and I had to, you know, build trust with them and, you know, earn it. So at some point, you know, let's say I was making the coffee, and eventually I'm doing well at that, and I'm making copies, and I'm doing well at that, and I'm driving people, and I'm becoming reliable. But then I can do something more basketball related. We trust you to work this guy out, and then breaking this film session, you know, this film down, and then leading the film session. So just trying to do really well at everything they give me, whether it's something I like or something I don't like, and then, you know, just learning along the way and trying to just add value, help out the program. That's really what it's been about.
Hey, plus being the only guy who knows how to run the film software, that'll get you a long way.
Yeah, that and it just really helped. Like, I looked at it that way, like it adds value for me, and that's great. But also, one, I'm watching every single team in our conference. We play in a high level conference. I'm and some incredible coaches. So I'm watching, you know, their stuff, what they're doing on offensive and defense, learning from that. But then at the same time, like, I'm in there early in the morning with Coach Danbrot, you know, giving him the film that he needs. And, you know, we developed that type of relationship where, like, I can actually give my input, or he'll ask me a question, and I'm not just guessing on something because I've just watched seven straight games of St. Bonaventure. I might have input that he wasn't, you know, considering, or maybe I can confirm an idea. You know, I'm so far from calling any shots or being like a go-to guy or anything like that, but it put me in the same room as him, and he's an incredible mind, and he has so much knowledge. So I got to learn a ton through him, and that was really solely due to the video.
Yeah, I could see where, again, being the only guy that is well-versed in how to use the software puts you in the room all the time, whatever film is being utilized. And we all know that, especially in today's game, film has become such an important way for coaches to improve themselves, and then conversely also to improve their team and their players. And it's become really critically important for players to be able to watch and see the good things they're doing, see the things that they need to improve. And if any time film is involved in a meeting, then you're involved in the meeting. That, I'm sure, gave you ample opportunity to be able to sit down in the room and pick the brains of what is a great staff there. So when you start thinking about Coach Danbrot and what he brings to the table and some of his strengths, what are just one or two things that you've learned from him that 30 years from now, when you're still coaching somewhere, that you're going to look back on your time with him and still think, boy, those are one or two really key things that I learned from Coach Danbrot back in my very first year of college coaching?
I mean, there's a bunch of things. There's a few that stand out. One being just him having a passion for the game. I mean, you watch him on the sideline, you hear him in a timeout, in practice, in a huddle, like you could, or you just, if you're just speaking to him in just an informal conversation, like, you know, this dude is obsessed with the game. It's all he thinks about. I mean, he eats and, you know, eats, sleeps, drinks basketball. Everything that he lives is basketball. So that's something that stands out to me. Like, he's just all in, which I'm sure, you know, many coaches, many successful coaches are, most of them probably. But that really stands out. And then just as far as I guess I wasn't prior to this experience, because I played Division III, where it's really hands off. Like, on the weekends, you're not practicing on Sunday. You know, after practice, you go to the dining hall, you go home. Like, it's more hands off. Division I, you're just so much more involved in their lives. But to see him and how he, like, takes on these guys and tries to develop relationships and molds them, and, you know, it's something I really haven't seen, where, like, the first time I ever heard it, you know, he's in conversation with one of our guys and I hear him say, "All right, love you," like, "love you," and the player says, "love you back." I mean, that's special to me. Like, I had no idea that type of relationship could really exist. So that's one of those things that also stands out as well. And then on top of that, I mean, just a total basketball mind. And I'm sure, because you played against him, was he at Akron when you were at Kent?
He was. I kind of think that he was not, like, that we missed the connection, that he was okay. Not there during the direct time. Obviously I played against Carl and Charles. Right. When they were at Eastern. So I spent 3 years going against the two of them, which was a lot of fun. And they're two great guys, which I'm sure you can vouch for.
Oh yeah.
But I mean, I've circled Coach Danbrot through all the different circles and different places that he's been over the course of his career. So certainly I'm familiar with, you know, with everything that he's done in the game, and just what an outstanding coach that he's been. Every place he's gone, he's had success.
Yeah, and what I was going to refer to with that was just his, like, the X's and O's of the game and his knowledge of the game, and, you know, just watching, I mean, his offense and how many different variations and different actions he's running, and how, you know, my knowledge of defense has improved so much with him, because he's like one of those old school coaches who is very defensive oriented. And that's, I mean, it's been huge for me. And in 1 year, it just excites me, because if I could learn that much from him and from the other guys on my staff and my players and the experiences and stuff, if I can learn that in 1 year, then, you know, I'm just excited for what I hope to be a lifetime of experience in basketball.
Yeah, to be able to be around people who know the game, who are just tremendous teachers of the game, and then, as you talked about a few minutes ago, that are also building relationships with your players, that's something that I think is special, and that's something that I think you see much more of in today's game. You see more of a focus from coaches on building that relationship. There's far less of the my way or the highway coaches than there used to be during the time when I was growing up. That seemed to be more of the Bob Knight model of coaching, where the relationship part of it was secondary to the basketball piece of it. And I think now we've come around and come full circle to where coaches understand that in order to get the best out of somebody as a basketball player, you also have to be able to build that relationship with them and develop that relationship with them. And when you do, that's when you end up with success both on and off the court, and then long-term success in terms of the player being able to go out when they leave your program and be successful, and then continue to have that opportunity to reach back to their coaches. And I think one of the things that's most satisfying, and I just felt this the other day when I got reconnected with Coach Grube after many, many years, to be able to sit down and have a conversation with him, and felt like that, you know, it felt like that was just yesterday that he and I were spending, you know, hours and hours every day together. It's amazing the bond that can be built over the course of that time, just because of the intensity of that experience. And I think that's one of the things that when I think about what coaching is, both from me being an athlete and being coached, and then me being a coach and coaching athletes, I think that that relationship piece of it is something that I don't know that I valued it that much necessarily as a player. And I don't know that I valued it that much early on in my coaching career. But I think as time went on, you start to realize that the wins and losses kind of melt away, and the season records and all that stuff. And really what you remember are the individual players. You remember the teams. You remember the moments. And that's really what's important. It's not, hey, we went 18-4 this year, and the next year we were only 12-10 or whatever it is. You more remember the people, and that really is what it's all about. And I know at the Division I level and at the NBA level where you've been, clearly wins and losses dictates whether or not you have a job. So certainly you have to win. But I do think that there's been a greater emphasis and a greater understanding that relationships can help you to win. And I'm sure that's what you saw over the course of your year at Duquesne this past season.
And a really cool thing and unique aspect of Duquesne and Coach Dambrot is his entire staff played. So Carl and Charles have this, I mean, I don't know, 40-year relationship with Coach, no, 30-plus year relationship with Coach Dambrot. I mean, they recruited him, they were 17 years old. Terry Wygan, one of the assistants, played for him at Ashland. Rick McFadden played for him at Akron. The list goes on. So they all played for him, and they all know each other very well. But they just, and they're great friends, but they just accepted me. And in 1 year, like I feel that I have a family. You know, right now we're anticipating to go back sometime soon, and it's kind of it's a tough transition. I've been at home with my parents, who I haven't spent a lot of time with for the past 6 years, just being away. And you know, it's tough to leave them. But then I think, you know, I try to just look at it, frame it positively. Like, I'm going back to this family of people who all have my back and who are extremely supportive and have taken me in. So I feel really lucky to be, you know, to be where I'm at with that staff.
Absolutely. All right, we're coming up. We just passed the hour and a half mark. So I want to give you a chance to share your contact information so that people can reach out to you, find out more about what you're doing, what you're all about, share your social media handles, if there's anything that we didn't touch on, one final point that you want to make, you can go ahead and do that. And then I'll jump back in and we'll wrap up the episode.
All right. So as far as contact information, my email is sternA, that's S-T-E-R-N-A, at duq.edu. And I don't know who would want to talk to me, but if anyone does want to talk to me, they can reach out to me, whether it's, you know, anything, questions, or if I can help them with anything, they can always reach out to me. It's kind of funny, like over this time, I've done, you know, the same thing that I've always done, try to connect with people and try to latch on and just learn from different people and gain different perspectives. And I've started to see different, you know, a lot of times it's student managers or, you know, people still in college that are looking to enter in and kind of, you know, find an entry level position similar way that I did. And they'll reach out and ask for advice. And I think like I was just in that position a few years ago. So I, you know, I'm going to return the favor because the people who did the same thing for me, they're the reason that I'm here. And those people already experienced a ton of success and they were willing to talk to me. So I try to, you know, just talk to anyone. I've talked to, you know, different high school coaches and middle school coaches and managers and different people because I can, you know, I've learned a ton from them as well. So please feel free to reach out. I love talking basketball. Obviously, I've been going on for an hour, 40 minutes now. So talk hoops, talk life, anything. I'm always interested in talking to people. So I'm trying to think. I don't think I really left anything out really regarding my experiences or, you know, anything like that. I do feel where I'm at and just seeing the growth that Duquesne has had is it's really exciting because they went from, you know, they were a powerhouse in the 60s and then they went through this huge drought with, you know, not a lot of success. And Coach Dambrot has, you know, has come in and revitalized the program. And the hope is to just bring a lot of excitement to the city. And, you know, I feel really lucky to be a part of that. I have a lot of history in Pittsburgh with my family. So, you know, I'm just really happy to be where I'm at.
It's good stuff. I'm excited for you. I think that the things that you've been able to share tonight will definitely, for any young coaches out there listening, there's a lot of valuable hints, tips that you've given them in terms of their own career path and thinking about where they want to end up and how they want to get there and the importance of working hard where you're at, the importance of building a good, strong network. I think those are things that any coach can take away from our conversation. I want to thank you personally for spending an hour and 40 minutes or so with us tonight. It's been a lot of fun getting a chance to know you, talk to somebody who's right on the beginning of their basketball journey. We've had a lot of guys on here who have been in the game for a long time and they have a different perspective, and you bring a unique perspective being someone who's just starting out in the coaching profession. And I really appreciate the time that you took to spend it with us and share with our audience. So to everyone out there, thanks for listening, and we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads podcast, presented by Head Start Basketball.